We are often watchful over technology because as we use technology, it can change us. But also when we use technology or implement new technologies, it often shows something about who we already are. This was demonstrated to me this week. I was benefiting greatly from technology. A friend of our family was defending his doctoral dissertation. And because of the wonders of Facebook Live, I could almost be in the room as he presented his doctoral dissertation on the Aurora. And it was a wonderful thing, but I was trying to watch it on my phone, and with my fat fingers, I accidentally hit the unfriend button in the midst of this. And when you unfriend someone on Facebook, it's okay if you don't use it, because this relates to all of us. A little message pops up and says, "Don't worry." When you unfriend someone, when you stop being their friend on Facebook, we don't tell them that you have unfriended them. There's no notice to them, lest you cause them pain by rejecting them. You see, the engineers and the software writers who have developed this social network understand the very real, very human experience of rejection. Now, there may be some really valid reasons to stop connecting to someone. They're just an acquaintance or someone you met or someone you thought you would deal with more, and so you're just cleaning up your Facebook page, and so they want to spare them the sense of you saying something negative. But also, there is the reality in which we so live our relationships out via virtual connections that the simple act of pushing a button might cause great pain and harm to someone that is rejected. We don't like rejection. It is painful, it is fraught, and so if we can at all do it, we shield ourselves and others from it. And Facebook unfriending is just the tip of the iceberg. Those of you who have had business partners that you've worked with for years that suddenly changed their idea of where they want to take the business in a manner that leaves you out. Friends who suddenly disappear on us and stop returning our phone calls or our emails. Someone who we pour out affection and love for that we expect to return that to us, and they mistreat us in kind. Rejection is a part of all of our stories in different ways. And it brings fear, and it brings mistrust, and it brings uncertainty. And it is woven into the very fabric of human experience. So am I about to say, well, God has given us this passage so that we can handle rejection? No. That's not the purpose of this story of God's work in the life of Abram and Lot, that this discussion is so that we can read in our own experiences of rejection. But it does point to a larger narrative of how we relate to God, to his goodness and promises, and how he deals with us. And it speaks to the reality of humanity's rejection of a good and loving God and his covenant promises and blessings offered to us. So it gives us a larger narrative. It points to that experience of rejection that we all understand as to where it comes from in our willing rejection of God. And so as we see how God deals with us through the larger story, then we might be able to take our smaller stories of rejection and see how they connect to the larger. And in so doing, understand how our rejections are part of something bigger. And I said this is points to a larger story, and so we're going to walk through this passage through three acts in the story. Act 1 is verses 2 through 7, Act 2 verses 8 through 13, and then Act 3 verses 14 to 18. Starting with Act 1, we see how God's people bless others. We look at Act 1 and we see the collateral blessings that come with associating with God's people. For those of you that weren't here last week or just can't remember what we looked at last week, in the preceding passage, Abram takes his family down into Egypt because there's a famine in the land of Canaan. And he deceives the Pharaoh about the status of his wife Sarai. And as a result of that deception and the desire of Pharaoh to get them out of the land, Abram is blessed significantly with even more wealth than he already had. And so verse 2 picks that up, saying, "Now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold." It's described for us in verse 2. But as a result of that, as a result of Lot being with Abram as his nephew, as a result of Lot following him into Canaan and then into Egypt, it has an impact on him. And Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. Lot, who has spent time with Abram, the one that God has made this profound covenant promise to, is experiencing material blessing as he associates with Abram. On one hand, this is a preliminary fulfillment of what God promised in Genesis chapter 12. In verse 2, he said, "I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing." And Lot, who has thrown in his lot with Abram, has surely experienced the benefits of God blessing Abram. This is an expectation, as God's promises are fulfilled, that we should expect the disposition of God's people resulting in the blessing of others. We don't just see it with Lot here in Genesis chapter 13. Theologians point out how Laban was blessed by the work of Jacob. How Potiphar was blessed by the wisdom of Joseph. God predicted that this would be the case when Israel finally took hold of the promised land through Moses. In Deuteronomy 15, he said, "You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow." So great was their wealth and blessing going to be that it would flow directionally out to the other nations, and they wouldn't need to benefit from other nations because they would be so well cared for. The story of Naaman the leper is that of a Syrian general opposed to God and God's people, receiving the blessing of his little slave child, telling him that there was a prophet who could heal him. While we might be quick to focus in on this as a dispute, we need to back up and see that it is a result of the tremendous blessing of God to Lot through his association with Abram. In fact, a lot of conflicts that we see often come not out of negative situations, but out of positive situations. That when there is an overflow of blessing, when there is change, when there is growth, conflict often comes because we don't know how to deal with that blessing. If you read the early chapters in the book of Acts, the church begins to explode with people. And then they have the problem of, well, how do we care for these people as God has blessed us? Not only with Jews, but with Jews who are shaped by a Greek lifestyle. And then eventually, as the church begins to grow with Gentiles, how do we live with these people? And so this is what we have here. We have a conflict that has been brought about by God's tremendous blessing. And though it means perhaps a change in the relationship, Abram is offering an opportunity for Lot to share in the continued blessing. He doesn't want to cast Lot out here. He doesn't attack Lot or his herdsmen for what's been happening. What he does is he makes an offer to him saying, "We need to resolve this situation so that you can continue to be blessed as you live in the land with me." we should expect our blessings to flow to others. The direction of blessing, the direction of provision is through us to others. That as God acts in our life and blesses us, yes, with material blessings, but with every form of blessing God gives, with wisdom, with instruction, with provision, with understanding, we are meant for those blessings to flow through us to those around us. God promised to Abram, and as a result for Abram's children, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. God's people are meant to be a vehicle of blessing towards others. But our expectation is that that blessing should be a one-way street. The expectation as we enter into the world is not that the world should bless us, but that as God blesses us according to his covenant promises and provision, we are a blessing to others. I came face to face with this week. I called someone in the community about an opportunity for the church and this person to work together. It's a great opportunity. And basically, the person treated me as if I was asking them to do something horrible. That they didn't even want to talk to me. That what I was suggesting wasn't important. And I was angry. I was upset because I said, here am I, I'm offering you an opportunity. I am offering you an avenue. You aren't going to do so much for me in this. This is an opportunity for you that I want to make available to you. And they turned their back on it. And I was angry because I expected them to say thank you. I expected them to bless me in return, because I have forgotten that though I, as a pastor and as a member of the people of God, am meant to bless them, that I should not expect them to bless me in return. You know, as we, many of us celebrate Memorial Day tomorrow, one of the things that we will reflect on is that the church and Christianity has blessed this nation in its formation, right? That there are principles enshrined in our government that have come out of Christianity, particularly the Reformation. That's not saying necessarily the same thing that we were a Christian nation when we were formed, but who Christians were certainly shaped much of who this nation became. And because of that, we in the church will often expect that the nation will rise up and call us blessed. That the nation will say, thank you, church, thank you, Christianity, for making us who we are. When we look at God's promises, his promise is not that the world will bless us, though at times they will thank us, and we want to receive that with gratitude and humility, that the primary direction of our expectation of blessing is not our receipt of blessing from the world, but our receipt of blessing from God, which we give to the world. It makes us question where we are looking to for our blessing. Is the direction of our expectation of blessing from God, or is it from man? And how satisfied are we when we get it from other people? If you're like me, you want the approval of people all the time. You want the blessing of people all the time. We're always looking for it, and whenever there's a hint of unblessing or dissatisfaction with us from other people, then I find myself emptied. No, we should look for our blessing and our provision from God, that we might give him the gratitude, knowing that when we are blessed by God, we are doing it as those undeserving of that blessing. A few years ago, one of our sister churches had a fire in Exeter. And the reporters came out to interview the pastor, Steve McGee, about that fire. And they said, you know, how do you explain to people how it is that bad things happen to good people? And Steve said, the issue is not that bad things happen to good people. It's that anything good happens to bad people. When we begin to understand the disposition of God in blessing us beyond our deserving. Abram did not deserve these covenant promises. He didn't do anything to deserve them. God graciously started this train of blessing with Abram. When we understand that we do not deserve the blessing, we should not expect those who we bless to be deserving or respond in a deserving way. And knowing that, we will know how to respond when the inevitable rejection comes. And that brings us to Acts 2. In keeping with being a blessing and seeking peace, Abram makes a generous offer to Lot. Lot makes his choice. And as we pay attention, we'll see that Lot's decision is more than just a choice of land. It is actually a rejection of Lot and a rejection of God and a rejection of God's promises. Now, this rejection may not jump off the page at you. A little geography may help us, and it's okay if you're not familiar with Near Eastern geography. But kids, I need your help for a second, okay? If you're looking at a map and you want to know which direction to go, which way is normally up or forward on a map?
North.
North, okay? We associate our lives north. The North Star helps us associate north. There's lots of reasons we associate ourselves north. Well, here's the thing. The ancient Canaanites, the Hebrews, they didn't associate their lives north. They associated their lives east, towards where the sun comes up. Okay? So when they start talking about directions, and you're looking east, and I'm thinking about where I am, so east, which way is to the right? South. Which way is to the left is north. So how does that impact our passage? Well, after coming back to Canaan that God has promised, after Abram has worshiped God in thanks for delivering him out of Egypt and the blessings that he received, they've come to this place pretty well in the center of Canaan, in the center of the promised land. And so as Abram makes his promise and his offering, he says, "Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I will go to the right. If you go to the right hand, then I will go to the left." Abram is offering half of the promised land to Abram. Abram is offering half the promised land to Lot. You want the southern country? You can have it. You want the northern territory? You can have it. I will give you half of this land that God has promised to me. And what does it say that Lot does? He looks to the east, to the Jordan Valley. Jordan Valley runs along the Jordan River. This is the very edge of the promised land. And in all likelihood, Sodom and Gomorrah are just on the other side of the river, the other side of the valley, just on the exterior of the promised land. Now, we might say, well, that this is understandable. They have just gone through a great famine, and it says that this land is attractive. It's well watered. It's so beautiful that it reminds them of the Garden of Eden. It says it was well watered everywhere, like the Garden of the Lord. And so Lot chooses that land. He's rejected Abram's offering. And in so doing, he's rejected the opportunity to stay in the land with Abram. And in so doing, he is rejecting the covenant promise. He is saying, I will go to Sodom. I will go to this land that is well watered and green because I know I will take care of myself there. I will have what I need over there. Instead of saying in this land where there's been uncertainty and this land isn't yet ours. Now you may say, okay, well, I have the geography there, but is that the only sign? Well, remember, who is the one that goes up to worship the Lord? Who is the one that builds an altar? Only Abram is mentioned. Now, Lot, we find out later, is married. He would have been the head of his own household. It seems interesting that Lot is omitted. And there's other clues from the text too, because it makes very clear, now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. He's choosing to affiliate himself with those who are opposed to God rather than trust God's provision according to his promises in the land. He essentially curses Abram, and it does mention that God's future going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. It hints at what God promised he was going to do. Those that despise you, I will curse. We see the enjoyment of covenant blessing is not the same thing as enjoying the one who gives the promise, God himself. That even though Lot had every blessing and benefit from spending time with Abram, even though he was benefiting from God's promises, he was rejecting the God who gave him those blessings in the first place. Materially, but it happens spiritually as well. In the letter John wrote to the church that we call 1 John, he describes how this happens. He says in 1 John chapter 2, verse 19, "They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us, but they went out that it might become plain that they all are not of us." And so it is with Lot that he goes out from the land of promise so that he depends on himself and so rejects God himself. It's not new with Lot. This was the situation with Adam and Eve. They received every blessing that God had offered them in Eden itself. And when the serpent came along, they rejected the goodness of God. They rejected depending on his promises of goodness to what they hoped to get according to the serpent's lie. Just as Lot rejects the goodness he's experienced with God and what he hopes to get by moving his herds and his flocks and his tents. As we read this, this is my encouragement to you. And it won't feel like encouragement at first, but listen for a moment. Expect rejection. Expect it. Anticipate it. As God's people who are to be a blessing to others, as we have been blessed by God, we are to expect rejection. You may winsomely share the gospel with clarity and charisma, only for the hearer to walk away disinterested. We may love our neighbor as ourselves to be mistreated in kind. And in the midst of those circumstances, we will be tempted to believe that we have done something wrong, that we are bad. We need to remember that rejection does not equal that we did something wrong. Yes, there are times where people will reject us for sinning, and we need to take responsibility and we need to repent of that. But Abram has just offered half of the promised land to Lot. His choice of the promised land, how much more generous could he be? And Lot says no. We need to remember this because Satan is all too happy to use the avenue of rejection as an opportunity to shame us and accuse us as God's people. Because not every rejection is a sign that we've sinned or we've screwed up or done something wrong, but Satan will be happy to cow us and beat us back and to have us come back away from offering of a blessing to others if we experience rejection. This is particularly damaging when we let the rejection of others speak louder than the blessing of God. We will let someone saying, "You're not valuable, you're not important, you're not righteous," because of the way that they treat us, instead of asking, "What does God say us?" And Abram surely is in that moment. He expects that God's going to give him this land. He expects that he's going to be blessed. He sees signs of that blessing and anticipates more. And then suddenly Lot says, I don't want anything to do with that. So it is an encouragement to us that a rejection does not always mean that we have messed up and we should expect it, even as we are seeking to be a blessing. But it is also a warning, because it is not just that others can reject the good things that we do in the name of the Lord for them, but also that our lens and our view of things can be distorted so that we reject the better for what we think is the best, just as Lot did in choosing the valley over the real offering of the promised land. Just because something appeals to us does not mean it is good. Our value system has been twisted by sin, and we need God and His Word to help us discern what we should really embrace and what we should reject. And in Act 3 of this passage, we get a clear glimpse of what we have rejected. Because rejection often feels like the end of the story, but we see that God's covenant blessing continues despite the rejection. Understanding what Abram has offered, we understand the depth of his rejection. What must he have been feeling at that moment? His nephew, who he has loved and cared for since the death of Lot's father, is separating himself from him. Is leaving him, does not want to part in the covenant blessings with him, is going to live near the villages and the towns instead of continuing with the flocks and the herds. Perhaps he is questioning whether he made the right decision in worshiping God. And in that moment of likely self-doubt and uncertainty, maybe even anger, God speaks. God speaks to Abram in the midst of this rejection. And I just want you to consider that act before we even look at what God says to Abram. Just the very fact that God offers personal comfort to Abram in the midst of that rejection. And then this is what he says: lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, all the land that I will give to you and to your offspring forever. First, he is reminding Abram that the rejection of Lot is not the last word in the story. That God's redemptive plan is not defeated by the rejection of Abram and God. That God is indeed giving this land to him. And it's likely that Abram had maybe thought of Lot as his heir, right? Abram is old. His wife Sarai is old. And when God has made a promise to bless him through his descendants, maybe God was referring to Lot. Maybe he was using that relationship as the opportunity to make him into a great nation, for him to be a blessing to the nations through his future family. And now that potential heir has been removed from the situation. The link seems to be broken. In the context of that rejection, God reveals that his plan is far bigger than Abram realized. Look at verse 16. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. So far, God has made a promise to bless Abram and his descendants, to bless others, and that his offspring would someday own this land. Suddenly now, the promise is expanded so that he sees the depth and breadth of that promise in his offspring, not just being a few, but so large that they are numbered as we would number the very dust of the earth. Sometimes disappointment, sometimes setback, sometimes rejection is used of God to show us his better, deeper plan than our perception. Rejection does not get the last word. God does. Satan, no doubt, danced with joy that God's only son was mistreated. As Isaiah 53 foretold, he was despised and he was rejected by men. Jesus took up that identity, quoting Isaiah 1:18, where he reminded the people, the stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. In Mark chapter 8, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise up again. Peter, who was there, took this theme up in his letters and in his preaching because it so shaped him, because he was the one that rejected the idea that the Son of Man would be rejected. He was the one that fought against the Christ being put to death. He could not conceive how God's Messiah could possibly be rejected. And yet he came to see what Christ was saying, that he must be rejected for God's greater redemptive plan to be revealed. The rejection of Jesus was so that in that rejection, God's plan for salvation was revealed. His rejection meant our acceptance. The rejection of us, the rejection of God's promises, his blessings, and himself does not mean that God is defeated. God's redemptive plan, his promise to reconcile all things in Christ, whether on earth or in heaven, by his blood, goes on, whatever rejection we face. And God's covenant promises are to be enjoyed by those who trust him in faith. And though others may reject or disbelieve, those promises are not defeated. I think I've lived in New England now that long enough now that I can make a Tom Brady illustration. Most of you know, if you've lived around here long enough, that the quarterback of the Patriots was picked 199th in the 6th round. 6 quarterbacks were picked before him. Since then, those other 6 quarterbacks have played 191 games. Tom Brady has won 208. They have scored 246 touchdowns to his 456. I'm sure on that draft night, Tom felt like that was the end. And yet, as we have the benefit of time and hindsight, we can see that the story was not over. I share that story not because our calling is to prove those who reject us wrong. It is to point out that that rejection is not the end of the story. Rejection tells a story, one that isn't true. Rejection tells us that we are not a blessing. Rejection tells us that we're not good enough. The rejection of the world tells us that we are a failure. And it lies because those who have received the blessing of God are a blessing to others. Because the rejection is not a true evaluation of who we are in God. And oftentimes that rejection is not the end of the story, but God's opening the door to show us what he has for us. This is Ascension Sunday. And the whole world who saw Jesus walking the earth, who saw him put on trial, who saw him nailed to the cross, looked at him and were ashamed of him. Many fled and rejected him. And yet 40 days after his resurrection, in the presence of scores of people, he was raised into heaven as a demonstration that God accepted him. The rejected Savior was accepted by God. So the call for us is to trust in him who has accepted on our behalf. To ask whether we will trust in our ability to bless ourselves, the opinion of man to bless or curse us, or will we trust in a God who took on our rejection in order to bless us with all that is his? Let's pray.